We just sang, "Come let us adore him." Whenever I hear that Christmas carol, I always think of the Magi who come across the desert to adore this little baby. Just to come and adore him. Just to come and worship him. No other reason at all. Come let us adore him. This morning, what I'd like to do is just join ourselves with those Magi and come along the trip with them and see what it was like. I think it's going to turn out to be a little different than you maybe may have guessed. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 says, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, 'Where is the one who has been born the King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him.' When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him." Now, who are these guys, these Magi? There's a lot of tradition about these guys. Tremendous amount of tradition that just kind of bounces around. In fact, you can go to Milan and see their skulls. They have three skulls that are supposedly the skulls of these three guys. Apparently somebody was digging around one day and found three skulls and knew right off, oh, that's those wise men and those Magi. And so you can go. In fact, there's a tradition, even their names. You may have heard Caspar, Balthazar, and Melchior, supposedly. The tradition says there were three of them. The Bible doesn't say that. Tradition says they're there at the manger scene. The Bible doesn't say that. Actually, almost all of what people believe about these Magi comes from Christmas cards and not the Bible. But history and Scripture tell us quite a bit about these men, and so we're going to look into that this morning. If you pick up the average history book and look up Magi, it will say that they were pagan astrologers in the East. But the problem with that is, how did they know about Jesus? How did their astrology tell them that the King of the Jews was being born? And what is Herod so agitated about? The word for agitated means to be shaken up on the inside and just extremely disturbed. He's really, really worked up. What's the deal? Why is he so worked up? These three guys in robes come wandering in and going to Bethlehem. What does Herod care about that? And what about this star? By the way, about Herod, let me just tell you something right now. A lot of people believe that the reason Herod was so worked up, if you watch a Christmas play, a lot of times they portray it as Herod is a young man, and he's all worked up because he thinks, oh, this new baby born King of the Jews is going to take my throne. He's going to be a threat to my throne. That's not why Herod was agitated. Herod was not a young man. He's a very old man at this point. His life was nearly over. In fact, about 3 months later, he died. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. He was an old man. That's why we know Jesus had to be born before 4 BC. And so it's not that he's worried about this baby growing up and usurping his throne. It's something else. The word magi, it doesn't really mean wise men. And they were not kings. You know the hymn, "We Three Kings"? Actually, they weren't kings. They were thought to be kings in the early church because early church art portrayed them with kingly garb. Very extravagant clothes that they wore. And so some people thought that they were kings in the early church, but they weren't kings. And the word magi does not mean wise men. In fact, it doesn't mean anything. It just means magi. It's an untranslatable word that refers to a tribe of people in the East, a priestly tribe. Israel had a priestly tribe. What were they called? Levites. Yeah, the tribe of Levi. Tribe of Levi were the priests in Israel. The tribe of Magi were the priests over there in the East, in Persia area. So it's just a priestly tribe of people. You couldn't become a Magi other than just being born one. And they were leaders in the pagan religion in the East, in Persia. And they were very brilliant men, extremely, extraordinarily well-educated. They devoted their whole lives to education and furthering their knowledge. They were very, very smart guys, highly educated, intellectual elites. They were astrologers and astronomers. Back then, they did not differentiate between the superstition and the science, so they studied both together. They were educated in history, in science, in agriculture, in mathematics, in architecture, a whole list of categories that they were experts in, and they devoted themselves to education. They were also into magic and the occult. In fact, our word magic comes from the word magi. Now, as a result of their expertise in all those areas, they rose to a position of extreme prominence and influence. In fact, they were there They were there in the Medo-Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, all the way through. They remained very, very prominent. I read one source that said they lost their prominence, but all the rest disagree with that, and I tend to agree. They were very influential men. They were there with Nebuchadnezzar. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed Jerusalem and carted everyone off to Babylon? The Magi were there. And their religious, now this is the interesting thing, it's a fascinating thing, their religious beliefs, the Magi's religious beliefs were very, very similar to Judaism. They, and in total contrast to that culture where they lived, in Persia, they believed in only one God, which is unheard of in that area at that time. They had a sacrificial system that was very similar to the Jewish one. They had clean and unclean animals. Now how could it be that these people would have a religion that was so similar to the Jews when they're way, way off in the East? And all the religious people around them had a totally different religious system. What do you suppose the influence was that brought them to that point? Well, the answer is in Daniel chapter 1. Daniel influenced them. When Nebuchadnezzar brought all the Jews over to, and bear with me, I realize this is just history here, and we're going to go through this, try to through some of this history, and then it'll all fit together, and you'll be glad you sat through it, okay? But Daniel was carted off with all the Jews to Babylon. And at first, he showed these magi up. Daniel 1:20, the magi are always advisors to kings. And it says in Daniel 1:20, every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego 10 times better than all the magi and enchanters in his whole kingdom. The magi are the epitome of human wisdom. And Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were 10 times smarter than them. Daniel was an extraordinarily brilliant man. And the magi would have come to an end under Nebuchadnezzar because of a certain event that happened. He had a dream that troubled him. He demanded that they tell him what the dream meant. And lots of people can do that. You can ask numerous people to tell you what your dream means. And Nebuchadnezzar knew that. So to test them, he said, first tell me what it was. Then tell me what it meant. And you remember their response? Only God can do that, Nebuchadnezzar. That's ridiculous. And Nebuchadnezzar says, oh, so you don't have access to this knowledge you claim to have anyway. You don't know anything. You're all going to die. And he decreed that they would all die. Unless somebody stepped forward and could tell him his dream. Well, you know the story. Daniel stepped forward and told his dream. God revealed it. They were right. Only God knew that. But God revealed it to Daniel. He told the king his dream and saved all their lives. And they continued on. And as a result of that, he was placed over them. He became the authority over all the magi. Now, the magi would have loved that. Because you may be thinking, what, didn't the magi hate Daniel? No, no. They did not. They would have been thrilled to be under Daniel. You say, well, didn't they throw him in the lion's den? Did the Magi throw Daniel in the lion's den? If you think that, you've been watching VeggieTales. VeggieTales is a little bit off there. The Magi get together and they say, you know, what can we do to Daniel? We can stick cheese balls in his ears, or we can use him as a footstool or a table to play Scrabble on, or tie him up and beat him up, throw him out of Babylon. You know, the whole little song they go through, and then until I watch VeggieTales. But they're a little mistaken there. It wasn't the Magi. It was the satraps that did that. The satraps were provincial governors. But not the Magi. If you know anything about intellectual people, they love to be around brilliant men. And they would have just eaten this up, being under Daniel, who was so smart. So Daniel was over all the Magi. What do you think Daniel did with that influence? Think he taught them a few things? Yeah, he taught them all about God. How did these magi during the time of Christ, why was their religion so similar to Judaism, and why during the time of Christ were there believers over there way off in Parthia in the east? It was because of the influence of Daniel. Hundreds of years later, you know, it's not uncommon for a godly person to have children and thousands of years later have a godly influence. That is not uncommon. That's exactly what happened here. Now let me tell you a little bit about the Parthian Empire. You go off into the east, way off past Iraq, in that area, and that is called, during the time of Jesus, Parthia. Okay? Parthia. Rome, at this point, was the world power. Now, This is fascinating. If you can just sit through this history lesson, this is amazing how this all fits together. Rome is the world power, and they dominate everything except Parthia is across the Arabian desert. It's just a huge, massive desert. And it's so far away from Rome that Rome has trouble keeping an eye on Parthia. And so Parthia builds up an empire, and they become rivals with Rome. By the time of Herod the Great, who was the Herod that was there when Jesus was born, they had constant wars between Parthia and Rome. And when these two huge world powers came together, guess where they always met? Show the next thing, the map. Here's the Parthian Empire, way over here. And here's Rome. You can see the boot and everything. When they came together, guess where they met? Right here. Now show the next slide. See this little yellow thing? That little yellow blip is that whole map that we've been studying this whole time. That's where Jesus spent his whole life. In this tiny little yellow thing. Israel. And when these two world powers came together, they clashed right there in Palestine. Well, these wars were constantly going on under Herod. Now, Herod finally had driven them out, but the Parthians were a very formidable foe. They enjoyed war. They were known for enjoying war, and they were known for being tremendous cavalrymen. They rode horses, and they had bows, and they learned from childhood how to shoot bows from horseback, and they just destroyed their enemies. In fact, they had a custom when they would come and they'd just wipe out their enemies, and then they'd turn their horses around, they'd ride away, and they developed the skill of turning around backwards and shooting shots at their enemy as they're riding away. You know what that's called? A Parthian shot. You ever heard that phrase? A Parthian shot? Someone wants to get in the last word? That's where it comes from. One last shot as they're leaving. Now, just before Jesus' time, just before Jesus was born, the Parthians kept on coming over and fighting Rome. Now, the Parthians didn't have a royal line. They had a king, but you weren't born into a royal line like you were in Israel. You know how the kings were selected over there in Parthia? They had a senate that just appointed the king. And the name of that senate, the senate was called the Magistani. They were made up of magi. The magi were the people who appointed the king. The Magi were the most powerful group, and they were the kingmakers over there. They were very influential, not only in Parthia, but there's even records of the Caesars consulting the Magi for their advice, because they're so knowledgeable. Well, they could place a king in power, and they could depose the king. And early Christian art, that's why they were thought to be kings, is because they are so powerful, and they dressed the part. So, when they came to Palestine, for one thing, they wouldn't have come bumping along on camels. They would have been riding Persian steeds, horses. And they would have come with incredible splendor. And probably about 1,000 of the crack troops of Parthia would have accompanied them. And there were probably quite a few more than 3 of the Magi. Now this is after Jesus' birth. This is not at the manger scene. This is probably as much as a year later. Jesus is born. When Jesus is born, a star appears in the east. Then they travel all the way across the desert. So this is much later. So here they come with all their regalia, their whole army, all these Parthians with their bows and their horses, and they come riding into Jerusalem with the Magi. Now, you say, how did they ever get to that situation? If you just backtrack a little bit in time, about 30 years, then Herod was the ruler of Galilee. That area up on top, he ruled that area up on top. The Parthians came over and fought Herod and drove Herod out, just booted him out of there. And so Herod no longer has Galilee. Well, he wanted to be the king of the Jews. And so he went to Rome, and he was very influential in Rome, and he pulled some strings and managed to get the title king of the Jews. And Rome says, if you can boot the Parthians out of there, you can have all of Palestine. Herod says, fine. So Herod gets back, and he fights and fights and fights and fights, and finally wins. You say, how did he win if he lost the first time? Well, he did it with the help of Mark Antony, who was a Roman general. He had the Roman army helping him. So Mark Antony and the Roman army, and Herod and his army, fought for 3 years, and finally were able to get the Parthians out of there. Now Herod the Great is ruling all of Palestine. But there was constant war for a while, and finally after that there was a period of peace, and Herod actually achieved, after suffering tremendous casualties, a 30-year period of peace, where the Parthians didn't bother him. They were just over there in the east, just building their strength back up. Now it's 30 years later. Herod is old and sick, almost the end of his life. He had struggled so hard to gain this title, King of the Jews. And now he's sitting there in his palace. And here is dust in the east, and they come, and he looks out his window and sees the Parthian army and the Megasthenes coming. And he was rattled. That's why it says Herod was agitated. He was agitated. You better believe it. In fact, to understand just how agitated, let me just throw in one more little thing about Parthia. It's interesting, if you read in the history, the Parthians at this time had a king who was a big loser, Phrates IV. And the Magi couldn't stand Phrates IV because Phrates IV, just capitulated everybody. All he wanted was peace, and he gave up everything in order to have peace treaties all the time. And the Magi hated that. They wanted to overtake Rome. And so they were getting ready to depose Phrates IV. Right at this time when Jesus was born was just before the Magi ended up deposing Phrates IV. And so they are looking for a new king. And they were wanting to fight Rome. At this time, it's the perfect time. This is the perfect time to wipe out Rome, because Caesar Augustus was old and sick and feeble. The Roman army at this time was out of the country. And the Roman army at this time had no commander-in-chief because Tiberius had just retired. So this is just perfect timing. Herod is vulnerable. I mean, Rome is vulnerable, and Herod knows it. And now here come the Parthians. And so he's agitated. And then look what they ask in verse 2. Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? Wow. You just don't ask that to Herod. That is Herod's title. Herod spent his whole life killing people to hang on to that title. In fact, verse 3 says that Herod heard it. He was disturbed, agitated. And all Jerusalem with him. You say, what are they so upset about? What's the problem with Jerusalem? Why are they agitated? If you know anything about Herod, let me just tell you for just a second about what Herod was like. Herod the Great, he was a man of tremendous ability, really. Very interesting character. He was winsome. And he was a consummate politician. Very gifted politician. He always got his way. And he knew how to win people over. He was a successful military leader. He was a good ruler in a lot of ways. He brought this period of peace. He eliminated terrorism in Israel during his time. He even remitted taxes at one time when the people were so poor. He gave them their taxes back so they could buy food. One time, he even melted down some of his own gold objects that were in his palace in order to feed the hungry. He knew how to endear people to him. But he was insanely suspicious and jealous and maniacal when it came to his throne. Herod was above everything else paranoid, especially towards the end of his life, which is when Jesus was born. Very paranoid, and he was a heartless, ruthless, vicious man without a conscience. When it came to protecting his throne, he had fought so hard for the title of King of the Jews. You know, Herod spent his whole reign plotting murders. He murdered so many people. The descendants, there was a group of called the Hasmoneans that he wiped out the whole people group because he thought they might be a threat to his throne. Killed them all. You know, Herod, when he realized he was about to die and the end was near, you know what he did? He ordered that a list be made of all the most prominent names in Jerusalem, the Jews. And he says, the day I die, I want you to arrest all these people on this list and execute every one of them. Trump up some charges and kill them all. And they said, why? He said, because when I die, I know nobody's going to weep. And there will be weeping on the day of my death. And so that's what he did. That's the sort of person he was. He had 10 wives. His favorite one was Mariamne. You may have heard of Mariamne. And Mariamne's brother was the high priest, Aristobulus, and Herod decided he had a little bit too much power and he was a threat to the children. Invited him over to go swimming and just dunked him under and never let him up. Murdered his wife's brother. And then he decided Mariamne was a threat, and it was a threat to have her continue to live, so he killed her. And he had tremendous feelings. That was his favorite wife. When he never recovered from that emotionally. But he was so insanely jealous for his throne. If anybody was any kind of a threat, he just killed him. He killed Mariamne. And then he didn't want his mother-in-law, he didn't want her bugging him, so he killed her. He killed two of his sons. And then later just before he died, he killed a third son. The Jews said it's safer to be Herod's hoose than his huia. It's safer to be his pig than his son. Less likely to be killed. Anyway, all that background, you're starting to get the idea. When Herod saw these people coming and asking the kingmakers from the east coming with their whole army and saying, where is this one who was born king of the Jews? His title, he was rattled. And why was Jerusalem upset? Because Herod was upset. And when Herod's upset, everybody's upset. You know, when Herod ain't happy, ain't no one happy. Because Herod was, when it came to eliminating his enemies, was not very precise. He just shot with a shotgun and a lot of innocent people got hurt. And war with Parthia was no picnic. Last time they had a war with Parthia, the king came in and raided Israel's temple and stole all the stuff out of there to pay for the war. So nobody's happy to see these magi coming on on their horses. So people see that Herod is upset, they see what's going on, and they say, oh, this can mean one thing and one thing only. Bloodshed. This is going to be a bloodbath. So let's look at what happens. The magi come riding in. Herod goes nuts. The people are scared out of their minds. Well, verse 4, they arrive. Now here's where it all starts coming together here. Verse 4. When he called together all the people, chief priests and the teachers of the law, and he asked them where the Christ was to be born. Because they had just said, where is the one born king of the Jews? So Herod called the chief priests together and said, well, where is it? And they got an amazing answer here. Verse 5, in Bethlehem in Judea, they replied. And then they add this. They don't just say in Bethlehem, but they add this. For this is what the prophet has written. But you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. Now that is amazing. That they put together a little sermon here that's just amazing. They quote off the top of their head two different passages of the scripture. One of them is Micah 5:2 about Bethlehem. They have a very clever little rhetorical device they do. They quote the opposite of what Micah 5:2 really says. Micah 5:2 says, Bethlehem, you are the least. Even though you're the least, you're going to have this king. They quote it and say, Bethlehem, you're by no means the least anymore because he's born. And they're saying the same thing, but they're just using a clever rhetorical device to say it in a neat way. These are gifted, eloquent men. And then, without even, they say, where is he born? Bethlehem, and let me just throw in this off the top of my head, just happen to have Micah 5:2 memorized, that it'll be because of you, O Bethlehem, and they quote it. And then without even missing a beat, they go right into another quote, who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. That's from 2 Samuel 5:2, word for word quote, speaking about David, the great Davidic king. It's amazing, the thing they put together. It amazes me the little sermons that people just extemporaneously can just come up with off the top of their head. Astounding to me. These men were great preachers. These chief priests and teachers of the law, they're unbelievable. But as amazing and as true and as wonderful as this little sermon is, the incredible thing is they didn't listen to their own sermon. They just preached about he's going to be born in Bethlehem. I mean, he is born. He's in Bethlehem right now. The King of the Jews, the Messiah. Amen. Now open your hymn books and start closing them. And they put together this incredible thing. And the magi are like, oh, great, let's go. And the chief priests, they don't come. Aren't you coming? No. This would have been amazing to those magi. Those magi traveled hundreds of miles across an incredible, huge, desolate desert just to worship this new baby that was born, the King of the Jews. They come to Jerusalem because they figure the King of the Jews, that's the capital of Jerusalem, we'll go there. They say, where is it? And they get there and they find out. They know. They know right where it is. Bethlehem. But nobody cares. They must have been scratching their head. The King of the Jews, the Messiah is just born. We came all the way halfway across the world to see it. You're not interested? Such indifference. Such apathy. Unbelievable. They must have just been amazed at this. You know, last week we found that he said that he came to his own, and his own received him not. They came, they must have expected people by the thousands gathered together singing songs of joy that this new king was born, and they come and life is normal. You ever done that? You ever gone somewhere expecting some huge thing to be going on, and they go and nothing's happening, and you're thinking, wow, do I have the right day? What's going on here? And they get there, and nothing's happening, but the people know. Man, that would be a real damper on your enthusiasm. Well, skip down to verse 9. Look at their response. After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And that is a funny phrase in the Greek to translate, overjoyed. Literally, it says they rejoice. Joy. They took joy and they rejoiced it. It's a real extreme way of saying that they rejoiced. But then it doesn't end. It says they took joy and they rejoiced it. And the next word is great. I mean, they took joy and they rejoiced it. And they really took joy and rejoiced it. Then the next word is very much. So they took joy and rejoiced it. These men not only took joy and rejoiced it, they really, really took joy and rejoiced it. And they had a lot of that. And you know, you read this and you think, okay, Matthew, I get the idea. I mean, they're happy. The reason I mention that is I just think that is such a great lesson for us. In fact, I don't know if there's any better lesson for us in this culture, this time of year, than this. They walk into just unbelievable, indescribable apathy and indifference. And it doesn't affect them at all. They are just bursting with joy over the birth of this king. Isn't that a great lesson for us? We're surrounded by such apathy. We're surrounded by such indifference in a culture that claims to understand that this is the birthday of the King of Kings. But they don't celebrate that quite as much as they celebrate Santa Claus, you know. And you get into that and it's so easy for your spirits to just sort of dampen and for you not to get as excited about the true meaning of this. And if I were one of those magi, I can imagine myself coming in there and seeing that thing and kind of just say, oh, well, you know, maybe it's not as big a thing as I thought. And not these guys. They are literally overjoyed. Well, verse 7. Then Herod called the magi secretly, and found out from them the exact time that the star appeared. He wanted to know the time. Because when it appeared to them in the east, that's the time when the baby was born. He wants to know when this baby was born, so he can kill the baby. But he did it secretly. Secretly. You know why he did it secretly? Because Romans 1 says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of men who do what? Suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That's what the world does. You reveal to them the truth and they suppress it. They cover it up. They try and hide it. They try and put a lid on it, sit on that lid so the truth doesn't get out. Because the truth makes them uncomfortable because it implies that they should be answerable to a God. And they don't like that. So they cover it up. And they're always trying to suppress the truth. That's why they just break their back to try and push evolution. So that they can suppress the obvious truth of creation so that they don't have to be answerable to any God. That's why there's such an effort to suppress the truth and not acknowledge it. That's why they're so paranoid about somebody just walking down the hall in a school with a Bible in their hand. And they're not afraid of any other religious book because they're trying to suppress the truth. That's what Herod's doing. He's trying to cover up. He's trying the greatest cover up in the history of politics. He wants to cover up the birth of Jesus Christ. Now how hard can that be, really? I mean, Herod's the king. He's the king, the most powerful man in the land. Bethlehem is a little tiny, nowhere backward town that nobody ever heard of. I mean, it's like, what's that town? Egner, Colorado. You ever been to Egner, Colorado, anybody? It'd be like a baby being born in Egner, Colorado. And the President of the United States trying to cover it up. How hard can that be? That can't be that hard, can it? Well, didn't do too good of a job, did he? That birth ends up being the most celebrated birth in world history. Herod's cover-up was kind of a flop. Now the whole calendar is based on this birth. And everybody, that baby surpassed Herod the Great, didn't he? You say the phrase, King of the Jews, and everybody thinks of Jesus Christ. Nobody thinks of Herod the Great. Herod had a lot of political victories, but when it's Herod versus God, Herod loses big time, doesn't he? The most powerful man in the country tries to keep this thing silent. But it's pretty tough when you've got angels appearing, shouting this thing from the sky. You know, that's kind of hard to cover up. Verse 8. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. It's a lie. He wants to kill him, but they're just telling him that. Anyway, verse 9. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen in the east went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. They found their king. Now they're worshiping him. Now you have to understand what Matthew is doing here in chapter 2. Matthew chapter 1, how many of you had your devotions this morning out of Matthew chapter 1? The genealogy. You have that memorized? That your favorite passage of Scripture? A lot of people skip Matthew chapter 1. It's just a big genealogy. You know what the point of that is? The point of that is to prove that Jesus had a kingly heritage, that he was in the kingly line and to be king. That's the whole point of that. Matthew chapter 1 teaches us that Jesus is qualified to be king. In Matthew chapter 2, Jesus receives the honor that he deserves as king. That's what Matthew is doing. The whole book of Matthew presents Jesus as king. So they worshiped him. How do they worship him? What do they do to worship him? Do they get a pipe organ and start playing it, or get some stained glass windows in there and look at them? What do they do? What was their worship? What did it consist of? What was it? Gifts. Yeah, they gave him stuff. A gift. That's a form of worship. Now, at Creekside, we don't pass a plate. We have the offering box there in the back, and people just drop the offering in it. But, and I've said this before, we don't want anybody to misunderstand that. It's not that we don't view giving to God as an unimportant act of worship. It is an extremely important way to express your love to God. We have that offering box not for the purpose of raising funds. That's not why we have it. God is our resource, and He supplies His own needs. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills. He does not need contributions from us. If you're giving to try and help out God's kingdom, we don't have anything to offer Him. We give to Him to worship Him. And that is a wonderful expression of worship. To give something that's precious to you, to God. That's why we give. Look at the gifts that they give. Now, in that ancient culture, you don't ever approach a king without a gift. Even if you're a king, you don't ever, you always bring gifts to approach a king. Remember Joseph's brothers when they came. And so they bring gifts. They're approaching a king. These are the magi. But they understand they're approaching a king. It's a little baby or a little child. And it's three gifts, gold, myrrh, and incense. Gold is a gift for a king. You give gold to a king. That's a kingly royal gift. They're honoring the little child Jesus as king with this gift. Myrrh is a gift for burial. That is an unusual gift. Very strange that they would give him myrrh. Myrrh is what you put on somebody, a dead corpse, to anoint the body before burial. Fascinating. Little prophecy they're making. Probably don't even realize what they're doing. Acknowledging his death. Somebody, he was born to die, Jesus was. And we see it right here at the very beginning. And then incense. Now that's another unusual gift. You don't give incense to a king or a person or a prophet or anyone. There's only one use for incense, and that is as a worship to God. You give incense as a gift to God. Very significant, the gifts that these magi give. Gold, myrrh, and incense. Well, there's so much more we could say about this, but we've gone a while here. But I want you to think a few things about the story to apply to your life. I realize it's a lot of history, but isn't it fascinating how God, people have said history is His story. God orchestrates everything in history. He arranged this whole thing, even way back there hundreds of years before in this tribe of the Magi, having them influenced by Daniel and that having an effect clear up to Jesus' birth, this profound thing that happened. In fact, I was thinking this morning as I was putting the sign back up, about the reasons why things happen. You ever heard somebody go through some trial, some difficulty in life, and they say, maybe there's a reason, which is a silly thing for Christians to say, maybe there's a reason. Of course there's a reason. I mean, God doesn't do anything capriciously for no reason. And we've talked about that before, but you know what I'd like to suggest this morning? There's not. When a difficult, painful thing happens in your life, there's not a reason. There's not a reason. There's countless reasons. You realize what God is doing? God is orchestrating all of history, and He's already written down. It has to turn out the right way because He's already written down the way it will turn out. And you just think of the countless billions of decisions that millions of people are making all over the world, and everything orchestrating, all working out, and He doesn't control them like robots. They have their own free will. They all decide whatever, and it all ends up exactly how God planned. That is amazing. And He's fitting everything together. Now, can you imagine the implications? Every decision you make has thousands of implications on the future, right? I mean, the decision, say, of my parents to get married, all the implications of all six of us kids, and then all the things that we do in life, and the decisions we make, and the decisions our kids make, and then just countless. I can't imagine anything God does has just one reason. In the brilliant, grand scheme in God's infinite mind, things have thousands of reasons. The reason I was thinking of that is Daniel. I mean, the reason for the exile. The Jews were taken off to Babylon. Why? Well, they're being punished for their sins. It was showing God's justice. There's a whole lot of reasons there. But one of them was so that Daniel could get carted over and be placed over the Magi and have an influence over them. So hundreds and hundreds of years later, the baby Jesus would have the worship that he deserves when he comes into the world. Isn't that something? Isn't that terrific? That's the God we serve. Out of these groups that we've looked at this morning, which one represents you? Probably, I mean, you think of Herod, the Jews, and the Magi. Probably none of you are like Herod, just totally hostile to Christ. Maybe some. Probably not. But what about the Jews? Are you like them? Indifferent? The Jewish leaders? Just kind of apathetic? Thinking about more about, you know, lunch this afternoon than you are about worshiping Him? Are you subject to that temptation? Or are you an enthusiastic worshiper like the Magi who would just cross any desert just for the privilege of laying a gift down at His feet? Do you want to rise above the apathy that's around you? You say, how did the Magi do that? How did they manage to do that? I'd like to do that, but how can you pull it off? Well, how did they do it? They saw the star. And we don't have time to go into that, but they saw the star, which was a revelation from God about what was happening. They were exposed to the revelation from God about Jesus Christ, and that produced in them enthusiasm. You want to rise above apathy in your life and generate enthusiasm in your worship? Expose yourself to the revelation of Jesus Christ. What God has said about Him, the more you expose yourself to this, the hotter the fire will be in your heart for worship. Spend this month of December exposing yourself to the revelation of Jesus and worship Him like the Magi did. Offer Him the gift of incense. Honor Him in your life as God. Have you all done that? Honor Jesus Christ in your life as Almighty God. Bow your knee before Him and give Him the worship that He's worthy of. And then give Him myrrh. More than just recognizing that Jesus is God, but coming to grips with the reality that His bloody, bruised, lacerated body was laid in a tomb because of the evil things that we, you and I, have repeatedly chosen to do throughout our lives. He died on our behalf. Honor Him as the one who died for you. And then give Him gold. Gift for a king. You do that in your life, you honor Him as the king of your life, the sovereign over you, the one who has the right to demand absolutely anything of you without question. Do you honor Him that way? I hope so. Well, the real exciting thing about this is the star. You say, what was the star? What was that thing? How do you follow a star anyway? And what was the deal with that? Well, we don't have time. But Christmas Eve, I'll probably talk about that. That'll be a good thing. We're going to have a Christmas Eve candlelight service, and so we'll talk about the star on Christmas Eve. But for now, as Jewel, if you'd come up, she's going to come and play for us just one last time. We're going to sing, O Come All Ye Faithful. Just one verse, that second verse. Sing choirs of angels. Imagine yourself in this scene, in this setting, with the child Jesus and the Magi having arrived and the angels singing, and we can join our voices with them as we worship. Let's close our worship time with this. Father, we come before You this morning with our hearts bowed in humility and humble reverence and fear before You. And we acknowledge You as the King of our lives, as Almighty God, as the One who died for us. Father, I pray for everyone here. I just ask that more and more, as time goes by, You would enable us to worship You in these ways. Give us an insight into You this December beyond what we've understood in the past.